Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's March 13th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for startups that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS, and we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your startup launch better products faster, free up your bandwidth for innovation so you can nail your value delivery every time. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, or you're just not happy with your current state, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz, book a meeting with me directly, and we'll plot a roadmap for your success for free. Again, that URL is cloudposse.com/quiz. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like. Ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. For those in the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, please share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse and find the video there, or share a short testimonial about the value you're getting. So with that said, here are some announcements. All right, first one, Matt, you shared this one with me. This is nice. Amazon SES offers now the ability to set headers in the MIME format of your emails, I suppose. This is so you can add the properties like the x-something with like an unsubscribe URL. So you'll send more compliant emails. Anything else, Matt? All right.
Nope, that covers it. I just thought it was a nice addition.
Yeah, let's see here. Yeah, that's a nice addition. Another one with popular, with you know, a lot of demand, we have upgraded our EKS cluster module to support the new APIs available by AWS. So you can manage the auth config strictly through AWS config, AWS APIs. This is nice because previously there were so many hacks we had to come up with in order to manage that, leveraging, among other things, the Terraform Kubernetes provider and some local exec providers to wait for the cluster to come online and numerous other things. So Jeremy on our team has gone ahead and upgraded our EKS cluster to support those new functionalities. The best thing to come of this is you no longer need direct connectivity to the EKS control plane in order to manage the EKS cluster through Terraform. So this opens up the door for more easy local development when using EKS, and also more secure clusters that don't need to have connectivity necessarily through other channels, for example, a transit gateway or, God forbid, public IPs. So let's see, Jeremy, are you on the call today? He didn't join yet. So, yep, that's all I have to add on that. Unless somebody else, Matt, has anything to add. Nope. All right. So this is a breaking change in our 4.0 Terraform. We released it as a major breaking change, version 4.0. We provide an upgrade guide for how to upgrade to this version. There's some manual interventions you need to do in order to convert from the old way to the new way. Of course, it works perfectly fine out of the box if you're just provisioning net new clusters. All right, next one. Another one that you shared, Matt. So Amazon WAF now supports larger request bodies as part of the inspection window, so you can create rules that operate on it. Obviously, you know, the larger the request, well, maybe you're blocking those requests altogether. And if the window is too small, you can easily sneak things through that wouldn't be caught by the filters. So anything else, Matt, on this?
It used to be 8K and now it's 64K. So it's actually like a significantly larger
Yeah.
size that they can inspect, which is pretty cool. So,
Yeah. 8x improvement, right? Next announcement is something else. This one caught my eye on LinkedIn. So apparently some optimizations have been done behind the scenes for CloudFormation stacks so that you get configuration complete notifications 40% sooner than you would have before. I don't know what was done though to actually accomplish that.
Actually, they used to just give you two states. It used to be create in progress and then create complete. And now they introduced an intermediate state, basically configuration complete, meaning that all the API calls from CloudFormation are done. It's just waiting for AWS like to do the reconciliation and actually provision the resources. So you now get like an interim state and you get that back significantly faster to know that your request is done. We're just now waiting for AWS to provision the thing.
Okay. I thought you were going to say that it would return before, like, maybe all health checks and so forth have completed. Which would be another state, I guess. But all right. Next announcement is this. So HashiCorp has added into HashiCorp Terraform a few new functions that are long overdue. One of the big problems with Terraform in its current state is that you cannot you. The only way to consume var files is as actual inputs when you execute the Terraform CLI itself. So a lot of people have deferred to using YAML or JSON, for which they introduced decoders a long, long time ago. Ironically, they never did one for Terraform vars, their own format for those configurations. So with this addition and the forthcoming release of Terraform, you're going to be able to decode var files natively in Terraform. Now, keep in mind it's slightly different because when you use the Terraform CLI to pass a var file to Terraform, those would actually map to a predefined variable in Terraform. This is going to return a struct or an object or a data source or sorry, a an object containing that var file decoded. This opens up the ability for you to have multiple configurations and maybe reduce some of the parameterization that you have in your Terraform modules. For example, just specifying which var file you want to read, and then the rest happens that way. Some caution when doing that, though, because you're going to have to do all your own validation then. You won't be able to rely on all the variable validation that you get when you pass var files to the CLI. And I don't know what options exist to easily validate then those var files that you're not missing an input, that you didn't mistype an input in the var file itself if you're using this method. Matt, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, the only the interesting thing, I haven't dug into the source code, but I saw this pull request somewhere, but it seems to indicate that there's actually a provider, like they actually implement a bunch of core functionality as a provider that I guess ships with Terraform. That's kind of what it is saying there. So it says it lives in the Terraform.io slash built-in slash Terraform provider rather than being language built-ins.
So is this piggybacking on the new functionality of
Functions in providers, yeah.
okay, gotcha. All right, that makes sense. I didn't catch that, and I thought it was a little awkward that, wait, you're just introducing provider functions. Why are you polluting the namespace with more functions? Provided you just added that functionality.
Yeah,
But
although I can't actually find that provider like listed anywhere, but may it sounds like it sounds like they ship some like a built-in provider as part of Terraform now, like no matter what, that you always get that doesn't need to be
okay, yeah.
downloaded. That because it's not registry.terraform.io,
Yeah.
it's just terraform.io/built-in/terraform. So I don't know. So it sounds like they're moving a lot of these functions like out of the core Terraform engine and into an actual plugin, just like the rest of like everyone else would have plugins, but it's like the built-in plugin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes
So
sense.
like I said, I didn't look at the code, so I'm only reading what it said in this announcement.
All right, good. Anything else to add to this?
Just a quick question for, I guess, Cloud Posse in particular. As you folks see new functions like this, given it's not part of OpenTofu yet, are you folks writing, are you folks leveraging functionality like this before it's on
So
Open or trying to be compatible, I guess?
yeah, so the question is Cloud Posse adopting functions already as part of Terraform, given that it's in Terraform, the forthcoming version, though, of HashiCorp Terraform? So to be
Yes.
clear, the functions aren't yet available. They're in beta one of HashiCorp Terraform. And in a fourth in the 1.8 of OpenTofu, they plan to add it as well. Obviously, everything that OpenTofu adds is a re-implementation because of the licensing constraints. Terraform open, sorry, OpenTofu is a version behind in that sense. So it will be a little while. And I think it'll be a little while before we have the resources on hand to implement all the those functions or functions that we need to do as part of our providers. So let me say this differently. Does Cloud Posse plan to use functions in our providers that we maintain, and should we expect to see more functions from Cloud Posse as a result of these changes? And the answer to that is categorically, absolutely. Yeah, we're going to use those to implement the functions that we see are missing that we can use. We love moving more and more things into Go and having the power of all the language capabilities there. We have a forthcoming provider. Actually, I forgot to add it to the announcements here. Should we announce it here, Matt?
It probably needs a bunch of time and
Okay,
a demo for it to make sense.
yeah, we have something really exciting. We'll announce it next week at least, probably at the earliest. But that thing we want to announce is a perfect application of some of these functions that we want to make available. And there's a number of other things that we do. For example, we have a utils module for AWS, and we have a generic utils module as well for other things. And what we find is that using Go or providers and therefore functions is just so much faster. And at the scale that we have our modules and the number of modules that call other modules, if we can speed things up a little bit by moving it into functions and providers, that would be a strategic move.
Cool. I think that answers my question. A lot of it was just stemming from, hey, I'm more than halfway migrated to OpenTofu. Should I worry when I see stuff like this, especially when I'm watching
Right.
modules like yours and other popular open source ones? And I don't necessarily want to be on the bleeding edge here, so I just kind of want to follow the paths
Yeah.
that are well supported, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, you're on the bleeding edge if you're using OpenTofu. I mean, it's not a criticism of it, it's just that it is very new. As a function of lifetime of HashiCorp Terraform, it's, I don't know, 1%. So not even that. So what you can what was I going to say? You can stick to common functionality between them. You don't have to use functionality that is breaking. And if you are on OpenTofu, well, great. Now you can take advantage of the things that are coming out there. Not available yet, but the local state encryption or local state signing will be really nice.
Yeah, not to change this topic towards OpenTofu, I'm definitely looking forward to the local state encryption as well as the plan. But I know once they do that, I'm really locked in on
Yeah.
OpenTofu. So
Yeah.
I'm trying to, yeah, basically, I'm trying to. Right now, it's easy to convert back. All we did is swap out the binary, update our aliases and our dev environments, and it was super easy. So it was pretty straightforward migration for us. But yeah, when I see stuff like this, I just wonder where other people are at on their migration as well as folks like yourself that are publishing so many modules, obviously, when many of us are dependent on it, like which one should we stick to? It sounds like you folks are going to try to support both,
Oh
obviously.
yeah, we I don't want to in there's and there's two sides to this, right? You have your components, your root modules in Terraform, and then you have your child modules, the things that everyone else uses and includes in their root modules. I think that we will necessarily stick to supporting as many universally the lowest common denominator between the two languages. And like local state encryption, that's not a child module problem. That's a root module problem. So that's good. And root modules are closer to you as an organization, your company. And these provider functions, I think, are phenomenal that they are implemented this way because it's going to increase portability between HashiCorp licensed Terraform and OpenTofu. However, now seeing the writing on the wall here, this is interesting. I suspect this is a built-in provider function. This is what I have on my screen here with the TFRs decode and encode, precisely as a defensive measure such that OpenTofu cannot use those functions, anybody using those functions in their OpenTofu code. So, okay. I think it's great that both languages are going to, or tool chains are going to support functions. And I think this is going to create interoperability between them. But man, this just rubs me the wrong way when HashiCorp Terraform then, is doing this and explicitly using that new framework for exposing functions, but then doing it as a built-in. So as a defensive measure, presumably, so it doesn't work between them.
Yeah, and I just checked the source code, and it is definitely it's in the internal namespace. So it's like internal built-ins providers Terraform functions.go, and then they have all that stuff in there. So not only can they just like legally not do it, but they're also preventing like you can't do a Go import from an internal package of another package. So like
Yeah.
those things will definitely not be like available or easily like just imported somewhere else. So
So what was the library that people said that we should create, but this is really opening up the there really just needs to be there for the re-implementation of all of these in an open plugin, in an open Terraform plugin, and kind of neuter the value of having the built-in functions in Terraform Core if you want to write portable Terraform.
yeah.
So, all right. Anything more to add to that before we move on? Cool. Let's, okay, next announcement was something I think we probably even brought this up before, but I saw it somewhere recently. I was looking through and it just reminded me it's a cool tool. They're all, you got JQ, you got YQ, you got sed, occ, grep, et cetera. Depending on what format you need to work with, JSON, YAML, XML, CSV, et cetera, there's a tool for that. It's interesting that you have in SaaS, you always have the great bundling and then the unbundling process, and it's cyclical. Because at some point you get tired of having so many SaaS services. So can't there just be one SaaS that combines these three? Well, I guess tooling is doing some of the similar thing, and Dazzle is doing that for querying, and Atmos to some degree is doing that for Terraform. So with Atmos, we have the concept of vendoring. You could do that with vendor. You can also do that with Atmos. And then you have GoTask, which is a makefile alternative. Well, we have workflows and subcommands, which kind of takes part of that functionality and builds it into Atmos. So the idea of what we had with Atmos is we don't want to teach customers 15 different tools just to get the job done when we can maybe just bundle it all into one tool and do it that way. And we totally get the Unix philosophy. We came from that, but at some point it's just too many tools. So my two cents. Any more commentary on this one? Okay.
No. Can I just remake one more comment about the previous one? I was just looking at the source code, And they move the remote state data source into that internal provider as well. Not as part of this pull request. They did it
Yeah.
like a couple months ago. So it's interesting. Like, I think they're going to make functions that are like core things that are core functionality that have been core functionality of Terraform itself, and they're moving it slowly into this like built-in provider essentially. So it's going to be implemented as a provider just like everything else.
Yeah. But a
So
provider that Pulumi cannot piggyback on, that all these other things. So they see a threat, I think, in that sense. I
yeah,
mean,
so I guess
it's
how.
convenience by having in a monorepo managing versioning everything that way. So I get it from that side. But I don't necessarily, but if they've taken this very explicit multi-repo approach with almost everything they do, why is this an exception?
Yeah, well, I think this was all built-in functionality directly in the core. So now they're just refactoring it out into this built-in provider that you don't have to explicitly download. It just gets loaded like what every time Terraform gets loaded.
Oh,
But
remote state is a separate, was remote state built in? It wasn't a separate
I think
provider.
so. No, I don't think so. I think that was always just built in.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I stand corrected probably.
Yeah, it's but it's interesting that that's the approach. So I guess then I don't know how that affects anything, because as long as they're still using the old, yeah, I don't know how it affects anything, but it's an interesting implementation. I guess we'll have to see where things go.
All right.
And if you just one other quick comment, if you look at the list of all the closed pull requests, if you just go to like pull requests and then go to merged, you'll just see there are a ton of pull requests related to functions, like doing things with functions right now. Like, look at the first couple is like function. Then there's another thing down here about functions. And if you read a couple of these, they're really all related to doing stuff with functions. So it's kind of interesting.
I was just curious to see. It just feels like the velocity has increased a lot lately.
Definitely seems like it.
But I don't see a good graph here of anything.
There's a website called OSS Insights that might be worth checking out in your free time, where you can basically throw in everything from a repository to an individual developer, for better or worse, and see what their public commit history's been, as well as like pull requests open, close for a repo, things like that.
Could you look that up in the and post that link in the chat and just be curious to
Yeah,
circle
absolutely.
back to that?
And you just want them in the main Terraform repo, I take it?
Yeah, the main Terraform repo. It'd just be interesting to see if the rate of pull requests or change has gone up.
Yeah, absolutely.
So one of the nice things that GitHub's been doing is slowly rolling out a lot more fine-grained permissions. They recently did that also for access tokens. Previously, you were very limited in what you can do on that. One of the problems, though, has been managing actions and action runners, required basically being an org owner. And if you wanted to use any automation for that, well, you're kind of giving some bot org owner permissions, or at least administrative. I think this might be changing that. As it talks about organization managing organization runners and runner groups, for example. So, Matt, have you seen this one?
I mean, I saw the announcement, but I haven't seen any more than this paragraph.
Next announcement was one that actually we forgot to bring up last week. So I brought it up here, also shared by Matt. So they've introduced a traffic overview dashboard for WAF. So I guess you can see how your WAF is doing and the amount of requests being blocked and so forth. Matt, was there something on this one? Do you recall? This
I just really like that it now made it really easy to sort of surface things that the WAF is finding and reporting in a central place. Like it's a lot easier to actually see what's going on. But yeah, I don't know. Some of these things, like you read the announcement and you're like, how the hell didn't they have this from the time they launched the service? I ask that question a lot of times, but it's like,
With AWS, it's often that way.
But this is like pretty cool, like, top 10 match rolls and CAPTCHA solve rates and bots versus non-bots and all that kind of stuff. So it's
Yeah, CAPTCHA
all
solve
things.
rate, that's a really interesting one. That
Yeah.
shows your CAPTCHAs are being solved or not.
Yeah, well, if you see it dropping, then you know that there's some bot that's so that's like doing automated things and not doing a good job at it or something.
Or doing too good of a job if it's your rate has gone through the roof for some reason. So, and then this one here, I saw it as well. I didn't dig into it. There's just an overwhelming number of AI-related announcements, and it's like supposed to be the panacea of everything. And this kind of sounded like one of those announcements. Just reading a little bit further, though, it was interesting that it did solve a bunch of practical interviews from various companies. But I still remain skeptical that it's still that, how far along it is or not.
Yeah, I mean they were pretty like I think it says it there in that last part. Yeah, there it is. That they pointed at real world open source projects and it did almost 14%. It resolved almost 14% of issues unassisted, which seems
Jeez.
pretty cool to me.
That
Like that
seems
was
pretty
like,
awesome.
whoa. Yeah.
We could use that at the Cloud Posse on our module ecosystem.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you get 15% of the stuff done for free, that would be great, but the other thing is in that demo, I think it's that demo or there's another one maybe in the thread if you read that down below. There was one thing where it showed how there was like it was trying to debug a problem, it got some error, it didn't know what it meant. It added a print statement and then took the result of the print statement and then like used that to figure out what the error was and then resolve the error. So it's definitely not like, this is not like just, ChatGPT like spit out this thing, like whatever. It was actually doing real trouble, like troubleshooting. So
Iterative
yeah,
debugging the same way we would do.
we were doing. Yeah. So
That's
I
cool.
was pretty impressed by it. Like just, but again, I only saw the demo, but I haven't seen the thing really in action, but the demo was very impressive.
All right. Has anyone else taken a look at this or seen demos? Wanted to add something?
I have seen the demo for Devon. It reminded me of there was a local user group part in Southern California where someone was doing a demo on using agents, AI agents, where you basically say one is a product manager, one is QA, one is a software developer. And then you have the three going back and forth and basically building the thing you want them to build. And AI looked a lot like that, where it seems like it's using agents. And regardless, at the end of the day, it's just really cool. So, and to your point, it's just moving so fast. So, and looks like you've got the link pulled up as well. So hard to tell, but it looks like there's more activity.
Yeah, I can't really tell by this. What is the time frame?
This is last 28
28
days.
days.
Yeah.
Is that
And then you can
adjustable?
compare it with the previous period, but if you click that link, I think it'll double up some of the charts.
Yeah. All right. Doesn't seem to be any, well, over a 2 month period, is that then?
Yeah, I mean, over a 2 month period, it's a 35% increase in velocity of pull requests merged.
Oh, merged here is up 35%. Gotcha.
Yeah, that's significant. Like,
All
I mean,
right.
they could also be gaming the metrics too, just opening PRs or
Smaller
merge.
PRs. Well, merging that are merged. Well, I mean, they're doing that refactoring, right? So they're adding more of those functions and those have been merging. So that's obviously going to drive it up. But I think it still counts. I
Sure.
mean, we I don't think we Well, as this shows, we didn't see that kind of activity before, big, small, big or small. All right. And okay, yeah, one last announcement. Let's see here. We just added this to Atmos. Let's see if I got the pull here. So one of the things we've done now in Atmos is make it so you can get some introspection for everything you deploy. So if you use the standard Go template format here with the double mustaches and reference like Atmos stack file or Atmos component and add that with your tags, then you can set that at the root of your project. Now, everywhere, everything you deploy will always have a tag added for what component it was, in what stack it was, in what Terraform workspace, what file you can find the configuration that defines this resource. So this is really great for visibility for possibly new people coming to a project looking at resources deployed and not knowing where to begin. But also from a cost dashboard, you can now automatically gain insights, slicing your infrastructure in these ways through the AWS budget tool or whatever cloud. This is not AWS specific by any means.
And to find the list of tokens, if you're using Atmos that you can use in there, it's the same, the context that you or the output of like the Atmos describe component command would basically be all the context that you have available to you to pull into those variables where you can select things out.
Exactly. So yeah, whether you use that as tags or use it for something else, that's up to you. But tags is a great way now to surface that to any other thing on AWS. All right. So that was that announcement. Oh, we also have the dynamic providers, which we did not announce. I think I forgot to.
Yeah, we didn't. It's actually demonstrated on that same pull request if you look at it, but this one's better, I guess.
Yeah, I think this one's a little bit more concise. So,
Yeah.
we at Cloud Posse, we've taken a pretty opinionated approach, to say the least, about Terraform and how to architect things. In Atmos, we bake in a lot of those opinions and how to do things, but we also provide escape hatches. One of the opinions that we have is not relying too much on code generation. However, we have identified definitely there are opportunities for code generation that make sense in our cloud model for how to do these things. One of them is backend generation for Terraform. So backends in Terraform, in native Terraform, don't support any parameterization. And it's necessary you parameterize your backends. So we generate the backend configuration in Atmos if you want to. It's an option. We have recently added provider generation because, in much the same way, providers configures how your Terraform works. So this relates to the announcement we want to talk about next week that I'll bring up then. It's also valuable to be able to configure things like your AWS provider dynamically based on configuration. For example, specifying what role it should assume in a given context. So that's what this now does. You can specify overrides for your providers. And in doing so, we generate a file called providers underscore override.tf.json. This follows the override convention in Terraform that allows you to override any specific settings of what has already been defined. So here, overriding whatever is set for the AWS providers, assume role value can be overridden by some value here. Matt, something?
No, I was just gonna say I find the thing I find the most helpful about this is if we use this in stack config for region, and now you no longer have to copy and paste the region variable like into a million like root modules because like for the sole purpose of passing region to the AWS provider, you could just configure at one spot and rip out all the places you have region only for that reason. Like that was that one I particularly like.
Also, wouldn't this work well with required tags
Yeah.
in Terraform? Yeah.
It does. Yep.
So Terraform added some time ago the ability at the provider level. Maybe I clicked on the link that doesn't actually
If
talk
you
about
actually just go to the, yeah, I was going to say the
it. It
registry
was
for the
off here.
AWS
Okay.
provider, it shows it pretty well.
Here, ignore those tags. Where's
Yeah, there's required tags.
default tags? Here we go.
Oh, that's it, right?
Yeah. So this is another perfect example now. So together with Atmos, you define your required tags. You can leverage the entire inheritance model that we provide to you in Atmos. Generate the provider now, overrides file. So every single resource that you provision, whether or not that resource has explicitly added tags or not, will get tags. And I think this is an elegant solution to that problem.
Yeah, and when you combine it with the thing you showed in the first one of some reflection capabilities, you can now actually add tags to every resource that shows which Atmos stack deployed it, which configuration file, the time that it was deployed at, you know, et cetera, automatically.
Yeah. Yeah. So where was
Right there.
so with these here, the reflection you're talking about there. Yeah.
Yep.
So
So you could
combine
just
that
add
with the
those.
yeah. So to make it less hand wavy, let's see. I close the other I close the other PR, so that'll be too much going back and forth, but does that make sense? Anyone have questions on it? Was that too abstract? All right. Then moving on. So we got through all the announcements today. Let's get into some talking points and questions. Some of these were raised some time ago because we've had just too much material lately to talk about in terms of announcements. So hold on, I just wanted to see on the participants here. Isaac, are you here today?
I am.
All right. Well, let's get to your question finally. Is this still relevant to you? Should we still talk about
It is,
it?
absolutely.
All right. All right, cool. Let me start by introducing the question, adding some color from our experience, and then we'll let everyone else chime in as well. All right. So if you're using Slack or Teams or something like that, should you have your errors from your monitoring systems go into a dedicated Slack channel, for example, for only errors, or should they go into a Slack channel by team so that they don't get ignored? Well, this is something we've had to deal with many different times in different scenarios over the years. And I can't say that one size fits all, but there are a lot of things to consider. The first thing to consider is Slack even the right medium for doing this? It, you know, how critical are those errors? If that thing that you need to respond to is going to a Slack channel and you need somebody needs to do something on that, are they going to see that if they're in bed at 3 a.m.? And chances are they are not going to, depending on your team. So that's why you have other mediums to escalate these things too. So it take let's take it back a step further and talk about incident management and escalations and alerts. Because they're different. And I think they sometimes get all combined together. Alerts are very noisy. They're every single thing going wrong, you know, every 5 minutes or every 15 minutes, out of disk space, out of disk space, out of disk space. Do we need to send that to a channel? I don't think so, because that's going to cause alert satiety where you just don't pay attention to it anymore. And you have these channels with 5,000, 10,000 unread messages. Then you have like, who needs to know? Not everyone needs to know that information, and that's why you all should we stick it in the team channel. Well, you don't want anything automated going into channels predominantly used and consumed by humans. It's going to make it very difficult to stay on top of the things you actually need to stay on top of as a human and as working on that project, because that's topical. So if anything you need to think about, then channel, if you still decide to do channels, those channels should be broken out possibly by team. But how big is the team? How many different services? Do you care? Do all alerts have the same priority? Are there ones that you want to emphasize more than others? And now the question is then, okay, well, I guess, okay, so fine, easy problem we solved. We're going to have two different channels. So now it's two different channels per team. But how many apps does that team manage? And do all apps have the same level of severity? All right, fine, easy problem. Now we're going to create a channel per app, per severity, per team. And now we have an explosion of channels, and it's just ridiculous and not scalable. And it's because I don't think Slack was the best medium for doing that. So if we take a step back and we think about incident management, what we really want to do is aggregate or collect all the alerts happening and determine that some SLO has been violated. Now, if that happens, those belong in a channel, and those should be few and far between. You shouldn't be violating your SLOs constantly throughout the day, right? Or if you are, then you have other things to fix. So, what we do right now at Cloud Posse is we have one channel for notifications that come from like AWS, so we can stay on top of those in a team environment. What's nice about that is we can acknowledge those emails as they come in with a checkbox. We can have threads relating to those emails. But that's one specific service, it's one specific thing, it's AWS. And as soon as you have too many signals going into that same channel, you're back to the same problem. All right. So, pausing there. Any thoughts on that, Isaac?
No, that's helpful. I definitely didn't stop to consider about whether Slack is the best place for some of these, and I have to think about that. We're definitely suffering the fatigue, alert fatigue that you mentioned, and my biggest struggle was the fact that it's all too easy for people to ignore alerts. But maybe, it's true that some of those things are not that important and it's fine to ignore them. And so I think a huge chunk of the work is in really fine-tuning these sorts of alerts, notifications, et cetera, to the point where it is that you're sure that if it comes up, it's something that someone must stop what they're doing and look at. And then if you can get to that point, it'll help with a lot of the other issues that my team is facing, I would say.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I think you start conservatively. Start by only doing the ones that are guaranteed to be a big problem if you don't resolve it. Yeah, you don't want information overload. You also don't have any way to silence it really without like silencing the whole channel. And that's what's going to happen. It's just going to be passive aggressive. You send all those things there, and it works for the first week, and everybody is, jumping on it. And then they realize they didn't need to jump on all those. And then they just mute the channel because they got other things to do in their sprint. And I don't think you can prevent people from muting a channel.
No, I don't think so either.
Right. Anyone else have experience doing this for better or worse? Has it worked for you? Has it not worked for you? All right. Let's see. Next question was from Alex Atkinson. Let's see. Alex, are you here today? You are. Awesome. All right.
Hey, Eric.
Is this question still relevant for you? Let me pause there for a second. Matt, were you going to say something before?
Yeah, sorry. I was so not to open another can of worms, but I was just giving some thought to Isaac's question, and one of the things to investigate might be looking at the four golden signals, as brought up in the Google SRE book. And those four golden signals are basically like latency, traffic, errors, and saturation. So figure out what, like on the overall service, what the service latency is, like how much traffic, whether it's requests per second or whatever it is that you measure that in, what your error rate is. So like total requests, or total errors over total requests, and get an error rate and saturation to see like capacity. Like if you have 80% disk space and you're growing at 20% per hour, obviously you'll be saturated in a couple of hours. Like if you can measure all of your services at that high level and alert only on those things, then or the trends of those things towards a negative. And technically those are the things that are eventually going to affect your SLA. Those are probably the things that are most actionable. Like all the rest of it is noise. So like if you're getting a bunch of things that are alerting, but they're not affecting one of those four things, like right now adversely, like while you eventually want to get to it and fix it, the real thing is with limited time, limited resources, et cetera, like who cares? That's kind of, I know I'm being sort of snip about it, but that's kind of the thought of it. So if you can boil down the things that alert you to only the things that actually are impacting customer, service, like service availability or service, error rates or throughput or any of those things, the amount of times you get notified will be greatly decreased. I'll just say that.
That's very helpful. Looking at those golden signals will help to ensure, and I saw a comment in the chat about operational information not being equal to alert, and I think it ties well to what you're saying. I guess I have a silly example to give, right? So here's a problem that my team had, right? You'll be working on some Terraform stack. We use Spaceless, right? And then something fails, and people were working on this, and then they don't really pay attention to that failure message that comes back to their email address. And so someone came up with a bright idea: hey, we should just hook Spacelift into our Slack so that if our stack fails, we see it. And now I get a million of those. So would you call that operational, or is that a legitimate alert? Like, I just want to give a concrete example of something that is helpful to the team, but for me, it's annoying. And I feel like if you're working on something, you should keep track of it. Do you get my point?
So like I putting it back to what I said before, if I'm being a stickler about it, does any of that affect the latency, traffic, error rate, or saturation of your production services?
No.
Then the whole team shouldn't be getting alerted about it. Like, should the person who's working on it be told, like, hey, you just deployed something that failed and it has the potential to affect one of those things? Yes. But until like one of those things is actually affected by it, the whole team shouldn't be getting spammed by it saying like, hey, Pete just deployed something that, his deployment failed, but the system's still operating as we expect it to. Like, that's kind of dumb if you ask me. Like, tell Pete and let Pete fix it. I'm just using Pete as an example, obviously.
We're
That's,
sorry if
but
your name
like, yeah, sorry if there's a Pete in here that I'm yelling at, but in that, like, that's sort of the idea behind the golden signals is that, like, if you alert on everything becomes equal,
right.
right? And it means that you're interrupted by every one of those things, and the likelihood that you'll take action when in that scenario, like, exponentially decreases because you're quickly going to get alert overload. So as soon as we have a framework together that we say only alert on the things that actually impact my production services, then when you get an alert, inherently you know, like the latency of my, foo system has now slowed down, right? Like a request a minute ago took, 5 milliseconds to process, and now it's taking 50 milliseconds to process. That's a problem. Or the traffic has spiked significantly. Like, so now maybe we need to figure out why demand has gone up, and maybe take some action so that latency doesn't also go up as a result. Or the error rate just went up by 25%. Let me go look at investigate why. Oh, the reason is Pete just deployed this thing to production that broke, and that spiked the error rate. So we should start looking at what it is and revert that thing. But the fact that purely that a space left stack failed, like, has no bearing on your production system until something happens in your production system. So that's kind of my take on it. I don't know if all of that's the official Cloud Posse view, but that's my personal
No, I think
view.
that's fine. But then tying it back directly to this example, because this is actually something we solve,
Yeah.
Isaac. So if a deployment fails, we don't create an alert for it, we create an issue for it. And then if that resolves itself, we close the issue automatically. But that issue can now be assigned to an individual to look into. Now, some can argue that's also not the answer. So the answer is going to depend on your team. It can create a lot of issues, but you shouldn't have a lot of stacks failing. What the problem I see, especially with space lift, is a lot of companies will, only once a week log in and check to see they have a whole bunch of stacks that are failing, and then that number keeps on growing, and there's really no resolution toward it.
Yeah, and I'll add one more thing to this, and then I'll shut up about the whole thing. But like, so Datadog is probably the most the tool that I have the most familiarity with in this arena. But the idea, like, if you're using Datadog, if your system automatically created an event on the Datadog timeline, so like Datadog, if you look at it, has like a timeline of things that happened, and if you see like, deployed new version, Pete deployed some stack that failed, and 5 minutes later, error rates are now increased by 25%. Like, it becomes pretty easy to understand, like, those things might be related to one another. So let's go look at those things. That means that you actively go and look at that event timeline, though. That doesn't mean that event timeline comes to you every time something happens. Like, every event that happens doesn't come to you to say, hey, an event just happened. It's more of like you see an indicator that something's going wrong. You go look at the event timeline to figure out what could have caused like this thing to start going wrong, and then you investigate it. So, my two cents on that one.
This is all very helpful. I'm going to have to re-listen to this portion of the podcast, but thank you for your thoughts and feedback.
Yeah, and absolutely read the Google SRE book section on this, on the golden signals of monitoring, and read it another time if you haven't already read it. It's like chock full of gold, in that whole section there.
Yeah. And free. So
Yeah,
anyone.
it's free. Just takes your time to read it and understand it.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Cool. We are running down on time, Alex. I'm sorry, man. I gotta string you
Sorry.
for it. This is how I keep Alex coming back every single office hours, is I almost get to his question and then I don't, and I move on. Alex, can we get to this next week? Uh-oh, the awkward silence there.
No worries.
He th he thumbs up. He thumbs up.
Okay. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of the hour here. Thanks everyone for joining us for Office Hours. It was another great week of conversation. We host these calls every single week. If you haven't yet joined, go to this link here, go to Cloud Posse. Mastodon.com/office hours to subscribe. You'll get an invitation to your inbox and your calendar, so you'll not forget to join every week. We also take our office hours and syndicate it to a podcast. So if you want to listen to it in the car, just go to podcast.cloudposse.com and you can listen to it there. Finally, if you are interested in seeing how Cloud Posse can move the needle for you at your organization, go to cloudposse.com/quiz. Again, cloudposse.com/quiz. You'll get to book a session with me directly. We'll go through your situation and I'll let you know if that's something we can help you with. Thanks again, everyone. We'll see you next week. Take care.